So it was pretty embarrassing as a person of colour to be in that documentary. It turns West Africa into this place that needs saving, rather than this place that has its own policies, is developing its own solutions, is resisting these challenges themselves.
You're listening to Climate Curious, a podcast for people who care about the world but find the current conversation about climate change confusing, boring, or scary.
My name is Mariam Pasha, and I'm the director and curator at TEDx London and co-host of this podcast, along with the amazing Ben Hurst. Say hello, Ben.
Hey there, friends. I'm Ben Hurst, activist and advocate exploring what positive masculinities can look like, humble model, and climate normie.
This week, Ben, we are going to be looking at one of your favourite things. Do you know what that is?
What is it?
Wicked problems.
Oh, my absolute fave. Well, my non-faves, but also my faves.
You're not fave faves.
Very important. Yeah.
So, well, you must have heard there has been so much chat going on about the ocean, right?
Right. There's like loads of like documentaries coming out at the moment about the oceans. And I heard Adidas are releasing a trainer that's made out of fishnets, recycled fishnets or something.
Yeah, like I mean, that. The oceans are everywhere. And the thing is that a lot of these campaigns try to promote like one simple solution. And right. My marketing brain totally gets it. But my climate brain makes me think there might be something.
That's incorrect.
That is not
there
right.
There is no simple
there
solution.
There is no simple solution. If I've learned anything from this podcast is that these kinds of wicked problems, you've got to not get tempted by the fact that there's one simple thing you can do. And this kind of problem, or the oceans or what's going on with the oceans is something that intersects climate and trade and race and poverty and food security. Mm. And if I can say like the thing that I have realized that's missing from everything that's out there is a conversation about the people that rely on the oceans for right. their livelihood, for their nutrition. Often those people don't live in the West. And so I think that is what is missing, which is why I'm super excited to have who we have this week. Shall I tell you a bit about her?
Yeah, tell me.
Christina Hicks is a professor of environmental science at Lancaster University, and her work focuses on enabling equitable livelihoods, securing nutritious and sustainable diets, and supporting approaches to conservationism. And she works mainly in like coastal and marine areas. And recently, a lot of her work has actually focused in West Africa. I'm very excited to ask her about that. So should we just get started?
Let's jump right into it.
So, Christina, welcome. Thank you for joining us. I want to ask you a question I honestly never thought I would be asking anyone. Can you tell me a bit about sardines?
Fish are actually important because they've got what we call micronutrients, which are things that our bodies need in tiny quantities. So they're things like iron and zinc and vitamin B12. Mm-hmm. And they're really important because if we don't have enough of them, it affects our physical and mental development. And they're particularly important in what people refer to as the first 1,000 days of life. So it's really hard for kids to get the right amount of these nutrients. And it's really important that they get the right amounts in those first years. So that's why fish is a superfood from my perspective, really.
So is that why like people have cod liver oil tablets and stuff?
Yeah, I think, sort of. But I think a lot of the kind of tablets around cod liver oil and things is more, I mean, I'll probably get in trouble saying this, it's more marketing.
right.
And it's also more to do with how, so the benefits of fish in higher income countries are it's different to the benefits from fish in lower income countries. So where I work, diets are mostly plant-based. So people eat rice and beans and greens, right. and that's pretty much a fairly monotonous diet. And mm-hmm. so when they have these small quantities of fish, it's really, really important in their diets. But mm-hmm. here we have a really varied diet. We have loads of supplements, you know, added to our food. Mm-hmm. And then so when we have cod liver oil, it's to help with things like with our joints and to help reduce the likelihood of us getting coronary heart disease, which are, mm-hmm. again, sort of lifestyle diseases rather than diseases to do with hunger and not getting enough food or not getting the right food.
Right. So that's like a really big point really early on, right? That even the value of fish in someone's diet is quite drastically different depending on where they live in the world. So then what's, and fish give us micronutrients, which is really important, especially in the first 1,000 days of life. So what is the deal then with sardines? Are they like different to other kinds of fish, or are they the same as like salmon? What's the deal?
Yeah, so sardines are special because we've recently, well, I guess for the past few years, work has been realizing that it's these small fish like sardines, mm-hmm. but also, you know, indigenous small fishes in rivers in Bangladesh or pelagic fishes in lakes that have really kind of dense concentrations of these micronutrients. So sardines are like this superfood. And the added benefit of sardines is they are really, really cheap. So in many places in Africa, it's these small dried fish that are the most affordable, particularly for poorer communities and poorer populations.
Okay, so these sardines are super, super important. And they're important in kind of, as you said, like poorer countries that have that poorer diet. How does that link in with your work?
I published a paper in 2019 in Nature, and in that we just really set out to try and understand how many nutrients are there in global fisheries. And we expected it to be unequal because we know some countries can fish more and do fish more, and we know vessels from Europe go and fish in West Africa, for example. But we were really surprised by quite how unequal it was. And what we found was that in the waters in many regions, such as West Africa in particular, there were really high volumes of these key micronutrients that were being fished out of the waters. But when we looked at the diets in those coastal countries, the diets were lacking in the same micronutrients. So in some places, so for example, in Namibia, but also in Kiribati, which is in the Pacific, the local diets were missing up to 80% of the calcium or the iron that they needed. But when you looked at what was being pulled out of the water, the countries would only really need to retain 1% of the catches or 5% of the catches, and it would close those nutrient gaps. So it really highlighted that there's this massive inequality between who's able to catch the fish and who's able to eat the fish and where the fish is needed most.
So some people, Christina, might have recognized your name or you from the fact that you were in Seaspiracy, albeit briefly, which is the Netflix documentary that came out earlier this year. And I wanted to just ask you a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I haven't said much about it because I sent this one tweet after I realized what it was. And it was directed at my like colleagues to be like, just for the record, I'm not trashing what we've all been working to achieve. I think we've done great stuff. So that's not my thing. And then that kind of got picked up and massively out of proportion. As things on Twitter, yeah, I've suddenly discovered that they can do. But I think what annoyed me the most about it, and where I think Seaspiracy was a really good example of this kind of, here's the silver bullet that's going to save the world. Do this one thing, your job's done. You can back off and you fix the problem. B, I think it was the worst form of white environmentalism. These kind of, it was a global problem that's being experienced the worst in countries around the tropics, but it painted this very kind of, I don't know, archaic picture of, you know, white journalists and white environmentalists coming in to save the day from these brown plunderers to rescue these black helpless victims, which I think is problematic on so many levels because it completely undermines all of the fantastic work that's being done by people of color all over the world, in Africa, in America, in Europe. So it was pretty embarrassing as a person of color to be in that documentary or movie, it also just takes agency away from them. So it turns West Africa into this place that needs saving rather than this place that has its own policies, is developing its own solutions, is resisting these challenges themselves. And I did have a thought afterwards. I was like, well, maybe we've come to the end of the age of white environmentalism. To me, that really highlighted that actually we've moved beyond this. This isn't, we're not here anymore. We've moved beyond these simple Tarzan stories. And the movement has moved on, but not everyone in the movement has.
So why are they not getting the fish then? Like, cause I feel like, wouldn't you just go out and catch some fish? Like, do you know what I mean? I say that as if it's really easy to fish, like I'm a professional fisher. I'm obviously not, but I feel like if they're already catching all of those fishes, why do they not get to eat them?
Yeah. So that's a really important point. And that's what we started looking into. So fish is it's a really valuable commodity.
Oh,
it's,
right.
It moves around the world like no other food commodity. So it's the most traded food commodity. So often what's caught in a country is sold because of, you know, the economic value that you can get from it. But you also have even more fish is moved through foreign fishing. So there are legal agreements that countries have. So the EU has always had agreements to fish in West African waters. So their vessels come to West Africa, catch the fish and take it back to Europe. And that never even lands in the West African coastlines.
Right.
And that's what's legal. And then you've got lots of illegal fishing as well.
Right.
And the legal fishing, those agreements are made even worse because wealthy nations subsidize their fishing fleets. So the EU pays their fishing fleets so that they are able to travel even further to fish even further. So it's all a little bit messed up.
So people are just literally out here stealing fish.
Well, the thing is, it's legal.
Yeah. So they're not even stealing it. They're just, so is there like a problem with overfishing? And what's a fishery?
Yeah,
That sounds like a fish nursery to me.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so
like I think of like Finding Nemo. I don't know why.
So, I mean, a fish, I guess if you think of a fishery more like, so fishing is going out in a boat to catch species of fish. Mm-hmm. And you've got lots of different types of fisheries. So you have recreational fisheries. So those are people who just go out for fun. You've got subsistence fisheries, people who go out to catch fish just to eat at home. You've got small-scale fisheries. So these are often family operations and smaller boats. And they'll go out fishing and then they'll take some home, but then they'll sell some, often in the local markets. And then you've got the large-scale industrial fisheries where you've got like much higher intensity. You've got big boats that will go out with, you know, much higher technologies. So they'll be able to find the fish using their electronic devices. They'll have these massive winches on and they'll be able to pull up, you know, big schools of fish, bring them back and then trade them.
So definitely not a fish nursery from Finding Nemo. Fisheries are like the businesses of fishing.
Yeah.
Okay. And they can be big or small. Right.
Yeah. I get that. So it's like hunting, I guess, on land.
Right.
So it's wild. It's gathering. It's wild harvesting of wild foods.
Right. And so I'm assuming that the problem here is not like small scale family fisheries, right? It's not like the people who are just fishing to sell fish in the local market. It feels like the conversation is moving in the direction of the problem being the bigger scale and like the movement of these commodities all around the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you have small scale fisheries that are destructive, that overfish, particularly where you've got, you know, lots of people fishing in an area. But on a global scale, it's the industrial fisheries, the industrial vessels, it's the big businesses, and they're able to fish even harder because of these subsidies. So it's cheaper for them to go out fishing. They sometimes even go out fishing when it's not profitable to, because their governments subsidize that.
Right. It's just fishing for the sake of it. There's a lot of fishing going on. I feel like we've said the word fishing so many times. This is a real fish episode.
You know what this reminds me of is we were just talking, Christina, to Melinda Janke, who's an international lawyer fighting ExxonMobil in Guyana. And we ended up talking a little bit about essentially colonies that get oil, and how this is like an oil curse for them, and all this kind of stuff. And although it's not a definite analogous, it just reminded me that when we think about the way we exploit poorer countries for their resources, we often talk about like gold or cobalt or oil or all these things. But actually, in this case, this is just another way that richer countries exploit poorer countries, is by going and taking something that is a real resource for their own populations, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, the focus in West Africa is partly because it is such a productive fishery. So there's lots of fish in that area. And so it's very attractive for foreign vessels to go there and catch fish.
So, okay, so I want to ask a question. We're talking about the impact of these foreign fishers, the international nature of it, and the kind of exploitation. What role does climate change play in what's happening in fish and fisheries and all of this around the world?
Yeah. So for a long time, I kind of tried not to look at climate change, because, you know, partly it felt lots of people were looking at climate change, and I was more motivated with trying to, you know, figure out how we can just ensure that people who need the fish to live, to eat, to have enough for a, you know, dignified life could get that. But particularly in West Africa and across all of the tropics, you can't not pay attention to climate change. Partly because, you know, climate change is being experienced, and it will be experienced the greatest in the tropics. So we've got some work that's led by a colleague of mine, William Chung, from the University of British Columbia. And he's, you know, he's done a lot of work looking at what climate change is going to do to fish stocks, to the fish that are available to be caught. And he split it into the tropics and the non-tropics. And what you see is there are these real hotspots in West Africa, in the Pacific, where the available fish is going to plummet. And that evidence is really clear. In outside of the tropics and in polar regions, catches may even go up, but they're definitely not going to be hit as hard. So you've got this situation where, on a global scale, we all know climate change is not bad, but maybe the urgency of acting won't be realized. Firstly, because fish moves around so much. Secondly, because, you know, the countries essentially who have all the money and the power and decision-making power are not being affected as much. But right. In the tropics and in West Africa, you have this real kind of coming together of their stocks are going to be plummeted because of climate change. They're already being plundered by foreign vessels. So this kind of situation where they're already on the edge is definitely going to get worse. And I think by projections, it's as close as 2025 that the nutrients available off West Africa is really going to start dropping off quite quickly. So it's really urgent, which is quite terrifying, I think.
So how, like, where do we go from, where do you go from here? Like, how do you, that's a big question, I'm really sorry, but how do you fix that issue? How do we stop that from being exacerbated?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really difficult question. And yeah, it's huge. You know, I think there is a real awakening. I think, you know, turning the economic system on its head is not realistic, and it's not going to happen. But I think recognizing that climate has to be integral to decisions that we make around trade, recognizing that food security and a right to food also has to be included in those decisions, I think is really important. So that's at a kind of policy level. And I think at a personal level, it's just about becoming more aware of where our food comes from, becoming more aware of how our you know, our governments, you know, what trade deals do they choose to sign? Do they play into the global inequalities, or do they kind of actually have some moral principles that are, and environmental principles that are embedded into them? And so I think it's being more active political citizens, and being engaged and being aware and thinking about and learning about other parts of the world.
It's interesting because it actually connects with something a previous guest said about knowing where your food comes from, because I guess it's all about this knowledge. Like, that one piece of information may not change the world, but if we all become more aware of not just where it's coming from, but I guess the trade-offs involved in it.
Yeah, maybe if we think of it through the economic system. So if our diets, through choice, become more and more homogenous. So if we're just eating avocados, or if we're just eating salmon, then that's going to be playing into, and I mean as a society as a whole, not as an individual, but obviously it plays up, then that's going to be feeding into an economic logic that says it's more efficient to produce lots of one thing than it is to produce a diversity of things. And that has impact on the environment. It has impact on the places that one thing has to come from, or the sources that need to, you know, feed that one thing. So I think diversity to me is just a good rule of thumb. Know where your food comes from, but eat lots of different things. So eat local, but eat lots of different local things that are available.
You mentioned something earlier and I kind of want to come back to it. You said that, like, for a long time you didn't want to really get into climate change, but realized that this is actually something that impacts your work. I want to talk about the climate change conversation and the poverty equality conversation and get your perspective on how these work together.
I mean, I think the problem is they don't work very well together because, I don't know, we seem to be incapable of recognizing that there are more than one challenges or there's more than one priority. So, you know, I think, you know, it is absolutely imperative that we get on top of climate and we put pressure on our governments to act and to think about climate emissions in everything that they do. And but that can't come at the expense of addressing inequality and addressing poverty. And I think quite often the urgency around the climate crisis can, you know, make it seem like, well, let's address this and then we can get on with everything else. But it won't work that way because inequality exacerbates climate change. Your people in poverty are the ones who are most exposed to the impacts of climate change. So, right. So poverty and inequality and climate change absolutely have to be headlining together. So I think it is so much about these strong coalitions across these movements and a built on a foundation of mutual respect and understanding that we may not quite understand each other, but we know we're equally important to each other.
And now it's time for our climate confessions. Let's fess up to the bad habits we just can't kick.
Okay, so it's time for climate confessions. And this is the part of the episode where we give you the opportunity to expose yourself and tell the whole world one thing that you're doing that you probably shouldn't be doing that might not be helping the environment. So we're looking for something that you're doing or something that you've done that is maybe not having the best impact on the environment. I don't know if you have anything, Christina.
I found this really hard, but I think probably it's not something that I'm done, but maybe it's something that I'm proud of, but shouldn't be.
Okay.
And it's that I have a massive family, like ridiculously large.
How massive
is massive? So my mum had 35 brothers and sisters.
Oh my gosh.
And when I was about 12, 13, we counted my cousins and I had over 100 then.
Right.
And I don't dare count them again.
That's a lot of cousins. That's a lot of cousins. But why is having loads of cousins bad for the environment?
Well, they say, don't they? I mean, they say that. So I guess having a big family and my mum coming from a big family means that I've got three kids as well. And, you know, I come from a culture and background where families are really important. And that's the one thing that I find. They do say, don't they, that we should be having smaller families, and they do say people have quite a big carbon footprint. But all of my family are in Kenya and Uganda, so I think they probably equal my husband's family that's here in England, but much smaller. But
yeah, we probably have a bigger carbon footprint than maybe they have.
Maybe as I don't a know, but they're quite. It's getting close, I think.
I love that your climate confession isn't actually something you've done.
But I've had three children myself as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is a hard one. And you mentioned it earlier, the idea of people choosing not to have families as part of their climate activism. I've heard that from some really young people. And that feels like a really major decision. That feels really tough.
Yeah.
Especially when you're hearing it from, like, you know, 18-year-olds. I don't know what the hell I wanted when I was 18, you know. And the idea that they've just decided that that's it. It feels really depressing, actually, I think.
Yeah. And I think that's also, like, a bit of a side effect of, like, climate anxiety and those kinds of things, right, where it's, like, I think somebody said in one of the episodes we did the other day that it's really hard to think about tomorrow when you're thinking about today. Like, it's hard to think about the future when you're worried whether tomorrow's going to come, right? And I think for especially for younger people, that it seems like there's this impending sense of, like, doom. Like, if we have kids, is the world even going to exist in 100 years or 50 years or whatever? So I imagine that's really tough.
Anything else, Christina, that you feel like you want to add to your...
Get off your chest.
Okay, so this one's really bad.
You saved the real one for last.
Last night, I had salmon for dinner.
Okay, now you have to explain why that's bad, because I don't know if everyone knows why. Not bad, but why that's part of your confession.
Well,
I'm gasping.
No, maybe I won't say that one, actually, because I didn't talk about salmon at all. So yeah, it's true, not red. It won't say that. Okay, sorry.
No, it's fine. We'll cut it after the first one. That's good. Okay.
I can say the dried mango one.
No, I think the family one is good because it's very different than the food I think. Yeah. Okay, Ben, obviously you're going to have a confession that is of the magnitude of having loads of siblings.
This has got to the point now where it is soul destroying. I feel like such a bad person every time we do this. I don't know if I can bring myself. Okay, I've got one. I do have one this week, which is every time. It's not even every week. It's like every couple of days. Whenever I go to the Co-op, whenever I go to Sainsbury's, if I go to Tesco's, if I go to the corner shop. Sometimes I do this when I'm buying, like, 2 lollipops and a carton of milk. Do you know what I mean? I could put the lollipops in my pocket and carry the milk in my hand. And I know that we're all supposed to be taking totes or, like, bags for life to the shops, but I never ever do it. And I got it from my parents. Like, it is a really bad habit that I have, but every time I get a new bag, and sometimes I buy the 10p bags, which is just stupid because I can actually use them again. And I don't do anything with them. I just, like, fold them up and store them underneath the sink. So I must have about between 150 and 200 bags under the sink at the moment. Like, it's a stupid amount of bags. Like, I don't know why I do it, and I don't need to do it. Oh, I do know why I do it. It's because I'm lazy, but I'm going to commit today to stopping. And Mariam, I really hope that you have one that's
I'm just going to tell you, for everyone knows at home, Ben has been involved in at least 3 TEDx London events. And at each of them, given him a beautiful tote. So it's not that he doesn't have one. However, I am not one to talk because I'm going to jump off your confession to tell you that I do something that's probably just as ridiculous. I use those 10p bags for life as my dustbin bags. So I will often forget to bring a tote, even though I have hundreds, and I will buy the bags, and then, you know, then you're like, okay, let me use it again as a bin, because the really big dustbins, there's only 2 of us, we never fill it up, it gets smelly, so we have like a little dustbin.
Yeah,
the problem is that I realized the other day that we'd run out of these bags for life, and I actually to my partner was like, oh, when you go, don't take a tote, get a bag for life, which is was supposed to be as an accident, and now it's become like a, it was supposed to be an effect, and now it's become a cause, you know what I mean? And like, so I'm gonna commit to actually buying biodegradable bin bags because I know they exist and use those instead of this ridiculous, also very expensive habit that I've gotten into. But I actually wanted to give everyone a climate confession update, if I can.
Yeah, go for it.
So I think a few weeks ago, I said that I love my electric toothbrush, and just as I was going to switch to a wooden one, I got an electric one, and I love it, and I was saying how I hate throwing out the plastic heads for them. And two amazing people, so Will Hawks, who was our bug guy from a few episodes ago, shout out Will, sent me a wooden electric toothbrush, and then Instagram and one of my team, both at the same time, recommended little bamboo heads for my existing electric toothbrush that are biodegradable. So I just want to tell you that we have fixed that problem.
Oh my gosh. Is there really bamboo ones?
Yeah, little bamboo. I think they're bamboo heads that you can get that fit on your existing electric toothbrush. And then when you throw them away, you don't feel so bad.
That's so good.
Yeah.
Oh, send me those. That's
really, I mean, we've not fixed the climate, but we definitely are a micro step.
We have single-handedly ended climate change on today's episode. So well done, team. You did a great job.
Imagine if it was so simple. Okay. Thank you so much for joining us, Christina, and for taking us on this tour of fisheries and the fishing world and climate change and conservation and the work that you do. It's so fascinating, and it's just really great to see another piece of this puzzle start to fit into place for us.
Thank you very much. It's been really enjoyable talking to you. We had some ups and some downs, but hopefully we've ended on a funny down.
Yeah, no, a high note. We're saving the world with recyclable toothbrushes.
Toothbrushes, good, yeah.
Thanks. So that's been quite an episode, Ben. Right. And I feel like you said it at the top, you know, this is a wicked problem. And I'm just curious to know, like, what did you take away from this that really stood out for you?
Well, do you know what? I think for me, there's two big things, right? And the first one is that we say it all the time, but it's really true, right? There are no simple solutions to the problem. There's no like one thing that you can do that will solve the situation. Maybe one thing to take away is that that's not necessarily a bad thing, and that can be quite an empowering thing, right? So it's more that everybody's got a role to play. All of us have different things that we can do. And then I guess another thing is that for those of us who like live in cities, it can feel a bit like there's nothing we can really do. Like it can feel so big and like, oh, how do you play your part in this particular problem? And I guess one thing that I got from it was like one step that we can take that's really easy is just caring about where your food comes from. That paying attention to where the fish that you buy in the supermarket is coming from. And maybe that can help make a bit of a difference.
Yeah, I love that. It really ties back into what Dee Woods was saying a few episodes ago and might be just such an important overarching message about actually caring. Because I think, I don't know, for a long time, I just didn't pay attention to any of this stuff. And that seems to be a massive way that we contribute to this problem. You know, Ben, what you'll be unsurprised to hear what I took away from this, which is that we should just be aware of when we're being sold a narrative that might be a little bit too, you know, Western in its perspective, and making sure that we're always including voices and perspectives from the global South, because I think without that, we just have half the picture, and that can be really dangerous. So I'm just so excited that Christina took us through all of that.
Yeah. I think not forgetting about the people is always super important, right? Like that's definitely one big takeaway that I've got from this whole season is like, this is not just about the planet. This is also about the people who are part of the planet. So we've got to remember that.
On that note, we'll see you next week.
Yes, we will. And remember, stay curious. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We really hope you enjoyed this episode.
If you did, Please rate, subscribe, and share this episode with a curious friend. It makes us possible to keep making this amazing content for you.
Oh, and slide into our DMs at TEDx London and let us know which climate extraordinaires you'd love to hear from next time. Oh, and don't leave yet. We wanted to tell you a bit more about who made this podcast possible.
Yeah, we did. TEDx London's headline partner, City, has been supporting us for the past 5 years to bring world-changing ideas to the TEDx London stage. And now they're taking it to the next level by making this podcast possible. Thanks, City.
But wait, that is not all.
No, this podcast was produced by the amazing Josie Coulter.
Curation and research by the genius Tara Cooper.
Artwork designed by the visionaries that are Sabrina Russo and Rebecca Mingus.
Mixed and engineered by the iconic Ben Beheshti, aka The Falcon, who also composed our banging theme tune.
Presented by me, Marion Pasha.
And by me, Ben Hurst. Stay curious.